Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What are the chances you tuned in today for the Healthcare Summit? I didn't think so. We spent a lot of time talking about this, but do you really know what you spend on healthcare? I didn't think so. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. And by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Thanks for joining us this February 25th. Tempers flared at times as President Obama and congressional Republicans faced off on health care today. But despite, or perhaps because of, the seemingly never-ending drama, a lot of Americans are greeting this debate with a shrug. Maybe because most of us just don't feel the full impact of soaring health care costs. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
President Obama brought up the issue of skyrocketing health care costs again and again at the summit.
Let's talk about the substance, how we might help the American people deal with costs.
But many Americans don't have a good sense of those costs. Most of us get our insurance through our employers. The premiums are deducted automatically from our paychecks. We're disconnected from the cost of health care. $5 out of every $6 in health care spending today is paid for by someone other than the patient. That is, your employer or the government through Medicare or Medicaid. So
nobody really cares about cost. And when that happens, then you get to where we are today.
That's Daniel Kessler. He teaches business and law at Stanford University. He says if people don't have to think about cost, they're more likely to ask for expensive tests that may not be necessary and press for high-priced prescription drugs they've seen advertised on TV. Glenn Hubbard says that puts a strain on the entire healthcare system. He's dean of the Columbia Business School and worked in the Bush administration.
Individuals will tend to, all else equal, consume too much health care. It's what drives up the costs of our insurance and our health care.
And Hubbard says it holds down our wages. He says if employers were able to spend less on health insurance premiums, many would pay workers more. Hubbard also says Americans would cut out unnecessary care if they had to pay a bigger share of their health care costs. The tricky part is making sure that truly sick people don't delay care they need because of the cost. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Just last week, we reported on the federal government's $8 billion vote of confidence in the nuclear power industry. Now comes a very different message from lawmakers in Vermont. State senators voted overwhelmingly to retire the 38-year-old Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports the vote is likely to slow the momentum behind the recent nuclear renaissance.
Vermont Yankee's owner, Entergy, has applied to extend its operating license another 20 years. Vermont is the only state where the legislature must sign off on a nuclear power license renewal, and State Senate President Peter Shumlin says it's time for the mothballs.
Oh, there's no question that this plant is finished. It's old, it's tired, and we don't want to be tethered to an aging nuclear power plant, which is owned by a company whose word we can't trust.
Investigators recently discovered that plant officials covered up leaks of tritium, a cancer-causing chemical. Shumlin says senators also worried about billions in financing for a spinoff Entergy has proposed to run the old plant.
Our judgment in Vermont is this makes Lehman Brothers and AIG and the other shenanigans on Wall Street look like kindergarten play.
The Vermont vote reverses some of the Obama administration's push for nuclear power as a cleaner energy source. But Steve Karekas at the Nuclear Energy Institute, an industry trade group, says the vote should speed up the licensing of new nuclear plants.
No facility is going to run forever, and so we need to plan now to meet that rising demand and to do it with carbon-free sources. And that's one of the reasons that nuclear energy is such a big part of the discussion today.
Entergy says Vermont Yankee is safe and reliable, and the spinoff would be good for Vermont's financial and energy future. But State Senator Shumlin says the legislature plans to switch away from nuclear power and aggressively develop renewable energy sources. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Ring up around 2 billion 12-packs of Coke. and you've got the value of a major deal in the bottling industry today. The Coca-Cola Company announced it's buying the North American bottling operations of Coca-Cola Enterprises for $12 billion. Confused? Well, the Coca-Cola Company makes the concentrate, the flavoring. The bottling and distribution process has been a separate operation. As Brett Neely explains, today's deal may put some much-needed fizz back in Coke's business.
I like to buy the world of Coke and keep it company.
Back in this iconic 1971 Coke ad, the world sang in perfect harmony, and Coke sold itself. Not anymore, says beverage analyst Tom Perko.
And we moved away from everybody just simply drinking nothing but Coke and Pepsi all day long. And we now embrace this universe of consumer demand in which people are trying anything and everything.
Consumers now guzzle everything from vitamin water to exotic energy drinks. Perko says the old model of separate production and distribution is over. Production companies made money selling the syrup. It was up to bottlers to sell the bottled soda to stores. Now companies like Coke want total control.
The strategy is all predicated on being able to move products straight into stores, new kinds of products.
Pepsi's in the middle of a similar deal with its main bottler. The timing of Coke's decision is no accident, says J.P. Morgan analyst John Fauché.
Coke looks at this and says, well, we don't want to really do this, but we don't want to be at a competitive disadvantage, so we kind of have to go out and do this deal now.
Coke says the deal will mean layoffs for workers at some bottling plants, but will save about $350 million over the next 4 years. Fauché also says the deal means good news for big box retailers.
The ability for Coke to go to Walmart as a single entity makes Walmart's life easier, which at the end of the day makes Coke's life easier as well.
But it won't bring back the days of perfect harmony. I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Wall Street got the jitters today. Details when we do the numbers. What would you call it if I told you those never-miss-a-trick wizards of the financial world are at it again? This time, the New York Times reports banks are placing big bets against the financial future of Greece. The very same banks that loan Greece billions are now betting the country won't be able to pay the bill. The story points out it was the same kind of betting, using something called credit default swaps, that ended up pushing the global insurance giant AIG into financial collapse. Here's what Fed boss Ben Bernanke had to call this on Capitol Hill today.
Obviously, using these instruments in a way that intentionally destabilizes a company or a country is counterproductive.
Counterproductive, because all this betting against Greece is making its financial struggles even worse. Felix Salmon is a finance blogger for Reuters, and he's here to help us understand how this big gamble is playing out.
A pleasure.
So Mr. Bernanke says counterproductive. Is that an understatement or not? How serious is this?
It's not that serious yet. At the moment, it's not clear that the credit default swap market is making matters worse. And in fact, I suspect that at the margin, it might even be giving Greece access to the markets, which it wouldn't otherwise have. And it might actually be a good thing.
Okay, so help explain this, if you will. What is going on here? At first, we heard that Goldman Sachs and other banks were helping Greece hide its debt. Now we're hearing that they're betting against that very Greek debt.
In the first instance, what happened back in 2001 is that Greece wanted to make its debt levels look better than they actually were and to do some of what you said, hiding their debt. And they hired Goldman Sachs to help them do this with a currency swap. Now that everyone's found out about the currency swaps, well, we knew about the currency swaps as long ago as 2003, but nobody was particularly worried about them back then. People got worried a few months ago when they discovered just how big the Greek national debt was. Goldman itself doesn't have a huge amount of Greek exposure, but a lot of European banks do. And so the great thing about the credit default swap market is that the European banks can hedge that exposure by buying insurance, essentially, on Greece defaulting. And once they've done that, they can hold on to their debts because they're hedged.
What about the quote in the Times, though, about this being like buying fire insurance on your neighbor's house?
Well, it is like that if you don't own the debt to begin with. But the people who are buying these credit default swaps in bulk are the big European banks who have lent money to Greece. So, in fact, they're more like buying insurance on their own house. They're doing the responsible thing.
Or it's as if you help finance your neighbor's house, and when you see your neighbor having a little problem, then you decide to take out a little insurance.
Exactly.
So what's the problem here?
If the credit default swap market makes Greece look much riskier, then that can increase the price Greece has to pay to borrow money. On the other hand, if the credit default swap market didn't exist at all, then there's a very good chance that Greece couldn't borrow money at any price, and that would be a real crisis.
Do you think it's notable that the only bank that Mr. Bernanke mentioned today by name was Goldman Sachs?
Absolutely. It's very, very easy to demonize Goldman Sachs. I don't think we should consider this to be anything indicating that Goldman Sachs is uniquely evil. Every bank was selling these currency swaps to Greece and Italy and other countries back in the early parts of the last decade. And every bank is trading credit default swaps as well. Goldman Sachs is not unique in this.
So where is this all headed? Do we run the risk of this piling on factor of Greece not being able to service its debt?
There's always that risk, and there's always the risk it will spill over into other highly indebted southern European countries as well, like Spain and Italy and Portugal. On the other hand, if the liquid credit default swap market gives people the ability to hedge their bets much better than if it hadn't existed, then maybe the existence of the market will mean that Greece can continue to borrow through this current crisis and can get through the other side and will avoid the kind of extreme fiscal crisis that would be a consequence of not being able to borrow at all.
Your argument is it makes them be more responsible.
Yes, it does.
Felix Salmon is finance blogger for Reuters. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
The recent global climate summit left a lot of issues hanging at the end of last year. So the world is still trying to settle on a way to stop the steady destruction of the world's forests. That's a critical question, since the clearing of forests leads to more greenhouse gases worldwide than all the cars, trains, and planes combined. But hold on. Some lawmakers think they have a solution, and it relies on financing from some of America's biggest polluters. Michael Montgomery brings us this story in collaboration with Mark Shapiro of the Center for Investigative Reporting.
It's a basic equation. Forests pull carbon from the atmosphere. But when trees are burned or chopped down, that stored carbon goes back into the air. Jeff Horowitz is with the nonprofit coalition Avoided Deforestation Partners. He says one way to fight climate change is to change the economics of forests.
What we're trying to do is make rainforests more valuable alive than they would be as rainforests that have been slashed and burned.
In Brazil's vast Atlantic forests, some big U.S. companies are already investing in this idea. Several years ago, the U.S. Nature Conservancy brokered a deal between American Electric Power, Chevron, and GM. The companies gave a Brazilian nonprofit money to create a 50,000-acre nature reserve. What's unusual about the deal is what the U.S. companies get out of it: credit for carbon stored in the trees to cancel out their industrial emissions back home. Some of America's biggest polluters, like American Electric Power, like the idea. Mike Morris is CEO.
If you think about biodiversity and you think about the capacity of forests to do the things that they do, and you know that they're a very effective carbon sink, it just makes sense.
But companies like AEP have to know how much carbon the trees are storing to qualify for credits. Deep inside the reserve, biologist Ricardo de Brites is helping them do just that. De Brites drives a small nail into a guarachica tree. He wraps a metal measuring tape around its white trunk. Then, with some quick math, he calculates the tree is storing around 220 pounds of carbon, maybe enough to cancel out a week's worth of emissions from a Hummer. De Brites explains that credit for the carbon stored in this tree belongs to General Motors. If the amount of carbon doesn't sound like much, supporters of the plan say this: if you multiply that one tree by millions of others, it could help America hold down its own greenhouse gas emissions. That's got some U.S. companies really interested. Here's why. Legislation pending in Congress would put a cap on the heat-trapping gases companies can release. but the plan also allows companies to get around these caps by investing in projects that cut emissions somewhere else. And preserving a forest could be a lot cheaper as a first step than modernizing power plants. American Electric's Mike Morris.
What I'm trying to do is make sure that the cost of electricity to my customers stay as low as we can have it stay during the period of the technology rolling out.
Electricity prices may stay cheaper, but Greenpeace forest expert Rolf Skaar isn't so sure that letting companies buy up carbon stored in trees is the best way to cut greenhouse gas emissions. He says saving forests this way could amount to sidestepping needed regulations.
There's no way to ensure that we will avoid the worst effects of climate change, catastrophic climate change, if we allow polluting companies to continue to pollute here in the U.S. and simply sidestep their obligations to clean up their act by paying for avoided deforestation elsewhere.
Skaar says this way, some companies will never invest in cleaner technology. And there are other issues. Can anyone really guarantee that these trees will store carbon forever? What if there's a fire or a blight? Back at the reserve, Ricardo de Brites finishes his analysis of the Guarachica tree. So how much is the carbon in this tree really worth?
$1.
But that tree and the thousands more here could become a lot more valuable if U.S. legislation passes. Then the price of carbon could skyrocket. And that means U.S. corporations would set their sights on buying up forests like this one around the world. With Mark Shapiro, I'm Michael Montgomery for Marketplace.
Our story was produced in collaboration with the PBS News magazine Frontline World. Tomorrow, we'll look at how the project is affecting local populations in Brazil's Atlantic Forest. Coming up, why the suburbs are shrinking.
The cost of housing was apparently low enough to attract people, but the cost of transportation is so high that they can't afford to live there anymore.
But first, let's do the numbers. The markets turned an early slide into a buying opportunity today on Wall Street. After falling nearly 190 points in the morning, the Dow Jones Industrial Average came back to end the day down 0.5% or 53 points. It closed at 10,321. The Nasdaq gave back just under 0.1% or 1 point to finish at 2,234. The S&P 500 reversed 0.2%. That's 2 points to wrap up at 1102. Fears about the economy and a weak jobs report got some of the blame. Goldman Sachs shed around 1%. J.P. Morgan Chase forfeited 0.5%. Coca-Cola shares lost nearly 4% of their fizz, but bottler Coca-Cola Enterprises bubbled up 33% on that buyout offer we mentioned. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.63%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. By American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. And by MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to updates on the economy and business, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for the month of January. A House Committee on Health examines the potential benefits and risks of the use of radiation in medicine. And his name is synonymous with genes. Levi Strauss was born on February 26, 1829. If he hadn't been, I just don't know what I'd wear most days. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. In a little over 2 weeks, the madness begins. 65 college basketball teams will be invited to the NCAA Basketball March Madness playoffs. Teams that win their conference's championships are automatically entered into the big dance. That's about half. The rest are chosen by a committee of athletic directors. Lately, there's been talk the tournament should expand to include 96 schools, which would mean an extra playoff round. Wall Street Journal sports writer Darren Everson is here to talk about that. Hi, Darren.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thanks. What could it mean for the schools that might be invited here? What would be the financial impact for the schools?
Well, besides just a visibility factor, there's also and clearly this is also something that fans worry about, whether this is just a money grab on the part of the NCAA. And the answer, of course, is sure, of course, there's a fiscal motive here, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. When you look at the shape that college sports are in, a lot of these schools are struggling, especially the ones that don't have another revenue-generating sport. So to try to maximize that revenue for those schools seems like an obvious thing to try to do.
Right now, CBS holds the exclusive rights to broadcast the tournament?
That's right. 3 years to run on that, but the NCAA has the right to opt out after this year, which is the reason why this has come up.
So how much does the network make from all this, and would they make more?
That's a good question. I mean, when the network package first began, the 11-year, $6 billion deal with CBS, at first it was thought of as a bloated contract on the part of the network that it was overpaying. And then now you see the NCAA looking at potentially trying to get out of it. So this could certainly end up being even more costly for the network or for whomever else ends up picking these rights. But as you can tell just from the interest this has generated, just the idea that the NCAA might go and put this out to the highest bidder, that this is still a very lucrative property.
Blow this out a bit. Who else could benefit from this? Cities, arenas, temporary jobs?
Certainly on the last two, because you'd have you'd go from having 64 games to having, in the current 65-team format, to having 95 games. And so you'd have that many more dates for these arenas and for temporary workers to fill. I don't know so much about cities, simply because the extra games that you're going to be adding, these aren't like some of the bowl games that have come on board. Bowl games have always been something that fans travel to because they have a great deal of time to book trips and to look ahead to the travel. The NCAA tournament doesn't quite work that way, especially if you're talking about adding an initial round of games. Basketball teams are not the sort of things that fans travel across the country to follow in great numbers. So I'm not sure that you would see a financial impact for cities in terms of fans coming across the country to stay in hotels, spend money in restaurants, and that sort of thing.
Does this not raise the stakes ultimately for, at long last, a college football playoff?
This is not something that would affect that, simply because the NCAA does not have the ability to go and just decide to implement a college football playoff. That power lies with the schools and conferences, and they just have not chosen to go that route.
Only time will tell is what we're saying here, right?
It's a great irony, isn't it, where that which is not broken is what they're looking to fix, that being the college basketball tournament.
Darren Everson reports on sports for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Republican lawmakers took aim at the Obama administration's foreclosure aid program during a hearing on Capitol Hill today. They complain many homeowners get only temporary relief and end up defaulting anyway. A top Treasury official responded late today that the administration is open to possibly forcing lenders to make principal reductions. There are lots of reasons families face foreclosure, but several new studies are pointing to a factor that hasn't gotten much attention: gas prices. From WNYC, Andrea Bernstein reports.
Alice Switek, a Polish immigrant, cleans houses in Brooklyn, New York. About a decade ago, she and her husband decided to look for a home. They found a nice-sized house in their price range, two states away, in Pennsylvania. But along with that size came a sizable commute, even starting well before rush hour.
In morning, about 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock is 2 hours.
Long, and with gas in the $3 a gallon level, costly.
This is expensive for one person when coming to New York.
Too expensive, it turns out. Switek moved back to Brooklyn, but many of her old neighbors in Strasburg, Pennsylvania, lost their homes to foreclosure. Paula Heeshan is the editorial page editor for the Pocono Leader newspaper. She noticed a distinct phenomena shortly after 9/11, marketing the Pocono Mountains, which had traditionally been a vacation area, as well within commuting range of New York City.
One of the developers was actually running an ad that featured scary scenarios of urban life with gunfire and pictures of rodents.
Heejin remembers wondering aloud with friends about the burdens the new homeowners were taking on.
If anything happened, such as an increase in the gas price, it could just tip the balance.
Her prediction came true. In 2005, there were 544 closures in her area. Then Hurricane Katrina struck Louisiana, and gas prices shot up. So did foreclosures.
The very next year, they rose to 835. 2 years later, they were at 1,200.
With the housing crash, it got even worse. Last year, there were almost 2,000. Scott Bernstein from the Center for Neighborhood Technology also noted this pattern. His group mapped every foreclosure record in the Chicago area from 1998 to 2009. The further from downtown, the darker the ring.
When you look at the map of foreclosures in Chicago, what you realize is that they're happening everywhere, but they're happening most frequently in places that are just less convenient to live in.
In 2008, when gas hit $4.30 a gallon in Chicago, Bernstein says some families were pushed over the edge.
The cost of housing was apparently low enough to attract people, but the cost of transportation is so high that they can't afford to live there anymore.
Studies in other major cities show the same phenomenon. It's caught the attention of the U.S. Secretary for Housing and Urban Development, Sean Donovan. He's trying to promote new housing in locations with shorter commutes.
Because ultimately, the combination of what the cost of that housing is and where it's located is really what determines affordability. And I think we can get to the point eventually where we have mortgages and a whole financial system that recognizes a truer sense of affordability.
So when the housing market picks up again, prices at the pump won't jeopardize homeowners. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note, which brand is it that just keeps going and going? Yeah, it's the slogan for that battery, but it might as well describe the Hummer. On the heels of news that a buyout offer from a Chinese manufacturer fell through, comes word today General Motors is looking at two other offers. The carmaker had said it would wind down the Hummer line. Now, stay tuned. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 53 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ gave up 1 point, 0.1%. The S&P 500 dropped 2 points, 0.2%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Hawes, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, the cost of conservation in Brazil.
It is denying them access to land that they have used for many generations and which they have maintained and preserved.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.